Support for WMNF comes from our members and the Straz Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the Irish Comedy Tour, taking the atmosphere of a Dublin pub and mixing in Irish music to the show. The comedy trio just released a DVD, Dublin Over, more at strazcenter.org or 813-229-STAR. I'm Duncan Strauss, really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll speak with Dr. Danny McVitie, a Lutz-based veterinarian specializing in hospice care for pets. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Joe Montgomery with Cool Cat here on Talking Animals.
Well, come on, cats, with your collars high, let's bug on down to the house of jive. Rod's outside, let's mighty fast, a cute little chick with a lot of class. I'm a cool cat, cool cat. If you don't dig the jive, baby, you better scat. I know it's a sound that turns me on. Man, oh man, I'm really gone. I'm a cool cat, cool cat. If you don't think I'm a guy, baby, you better scat. With two box of motor, sweat, I'm moving along like a sacred jet. I'm a cool cat, cool cat. If you don't take the jive, baby, you better scat. It don't take much to turn me on. When I stop rocking, you better look out. I'm a fast saber with a slow flame out. I'm a cool cat, cool cat. If you don't take my jive, baby, you better scat.
All right, that's Joe Montgomery with Cool Cat, an animal song to ease us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that's devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Dr. Danny McVitie, a Lutz-based veterinarian specializing in hospice care for pets. We'll discuss end-of-life issues for pets, euthanasia, and more. As someone said in response to a Facebook post I made about today's show, difficult but essential subject matter, indeed. So we'll discuss all this and more when Dr. Danny McVitie joins us in studio, no less, in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to see Frank Zappa tribute band Ugly Radio Rebellion performing Friday night at the Orpheum. And we'll speak briefly with Libby Busalis, whom you may recall as the Talking Animals family member who went vegan a few weeks ago. We'll check in with her and get a bit of an update on how it's going. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment, a look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon, produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item, very, very local. Last Thursday, Hillsborough County Commissioners voted unanimously to pass an anti-tethering ordinance in Hillsborough County, making it illegal to tie your dog without direct supervision. The vote followed a lengthy debate on the details of the ordinance. Commissioner Les Miller wanted an outright ban on all tethering, while Commissioner Kevin Beckner felt tethering should be permitted if the dog is supervised. That led to a discussion on what happens if the dog owner momentarily leaves the dog to go answer the phone or use the bathroom. Animal Services Interim Director Dick Bailey explained the goal of the ordinance isn't to penalize humane dog owners who walk away from their tethered dog for a few minutes, but to give animal services officers a basis to investigate cases where dogs are left tethered for days on end with inadequate food, water, and shelter. The new ordinance comes after nearly 2 years of debate and, I might add, tireless effort on the part of Barbara Lopresti. So kudos to her and congrats. Internationally, from Wellington, New Zealand, a mass stranding of whales on a New Zealand beach has left 36 of the creatures dead and threatens 40 more. Department of Conservation Area Manager John Mason said 99 pilot whales stranded themselves Monday on Farewell Spit on the South Island. By Tuesday, 36 whales had died and another 40 remained stranded or were still in danger. Mason said conservation staff and volunteers had successfully refloated 17 whales, which had swum out to deeper water. Another 6 whales remained unaccounted for. Might have heard or read about this. Seems to be popping up everywhere. Uncle Chi-Chi, a lovable toy poodle from New York's West Village, believed to have possibly been the world's oldest dog, passed away Tuesday following a tough bout with cancer, the New York Times reports. Though the dog's exact age was not known, it is believed Chi-Chi lived to be somewhere between 24 and 26 years old, according to the Associated Press. Back locally, mentioned this last week and made a kind of a little bit of a prediction. First, let me just tell you that Nathan Winograd, national author and animal advocate known for his innovative, creative ways to end the killing of healthy, adoptable animals, will be coming to the Tampa area to speak at a conference Saturday, February 4th. And the event is titled Save 90 because national studies show that 90% of animals entering shelters are healthy and adoptable. So Nathan Winograd will speak at this conference again Saturday, February 4th from 1 to 2 p.m. There'll be check-in, refreshments, network 2 to 5 is the conference itself from 5 to 5:30. Nathan will sign his book. This is now going to take place at the West Shore Marriott. I think we had mentioned last week that this event was on the horizon, but already the interest had outstripped the original size of the venue. So it's now at the West Shore Marriott, 1001 North West Shore Boulevard in Tampa. Again, that's Saturday, February 4th. And you can find out more by going to save90.org. And on a very related note, Nathan Winograd will be our guest on Talking Animals next Wednesday, February 1st, as a prelude to the February 4th event. If you like seabirds and you think, hey, I wish I could identify more of them, well, you're in luck. There's a Shore Seabird Identification ID class on the horizon. And that's going to be held February 18th through March 3rd. Each class starts on Dunedin Causeway to study shore seabirds through binoculars and spotting scopes. There'll be a classroom session begin at 9 a.m. and features a different suite of Gulf Coast shorebirds and seabirds. So you can find out more. This is offered at least generally under the auspices of Clearwater Audubon. So you can go to clearwateraudubon.com for more information. And with that movie Big Miracle set to open shortly, found this story. Bonnie Carroll is a well-known in veteran circles as the founder of a vast organization that provides grief counseling and help for thousands of families of fallen military members. But it was her involvement nearly 25 years ago in High Seas' effort to rescue 3 gray whales stranded off Alaska that is now receiving Hollywood treatment. Carroll and her late husband Tom are prominent characters in the upcoming Big Miracle, a film chronicling the Reagan administration's 1988 partnership with the Soviet Union, environmentalists, and oil companies to free the whales, an expensive and ultimately successful effort that drew international attention. Quote, what was extraordinary about this event was that it brought together the military, the Alaska Natives, Greenpeace, the oil companies, and finally the Soviets, Carroll said. Those are entities that rarely work collaboratively and are often at odds, and they all came together to save these whales. The film, which stars Drew Barrymore and Ted Danson and opens February 3rd, gives Carroll a chance to relive the dramatic rescue and her romance with her husband. But it's also a platform to draw attention to her group Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, or TAPS, whose work she says may become even more critical now that the Obama administration has declared an end to the Iraq War. The movie as a premier in Washington tonight. The organization was formed 2 years after Carroll lost her husband, Alaska National Guard Brigadier General Tom Carroll, in a plane crash. She fell in love with him over the phone during the whale rescue effort and wed soon after. Their happiness was short-lived, though, as Tom Carroll and seven others were killed in a 1992 crash of an Army C-12 plane in Alaska. Though she had worked closely with survivors of violent crime, she didn't find a comparable support network until bonding with the other widows of the crash. "Well, we really just had the same fears, the same concerns, the same questions," Carroll said. "It became very apparent that the strong source of comfort to speak with another person who can validate and normalize your own feelings." All right, we'll see if we have time to come back to some more things, but we've got Dr. McVitie in the studio. We got to get to it. So let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. When our guest is in the studio, as Dr. McVitie is, we tend to keep our comedy corner pieces very, very short, and today is no exception. This is Stephen Wright with part of a piece called Ants on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I'm going to court next week. I've been selected for jury duty. It's kind of an insane case. 6,000 ants dressed up as rice and robbed a Chinese restaurant. I don't think they did it. I know a few of them, and they wouldn't do anything like that.
All right, that was Stephen Wright, part of a piece called Ants on today's Comedy Corner. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's just about time now to meet today's guest, Dr. Danny McVitie. As I outlined earlier in the show, Dr. McVitie is a Lutz-based veterinarian specializing in hospice care for pets, whose practice is called Lap of Love Veterinary Hospice. We'll discuss end-of-life issues for pets, euthanasia, and more, and we'll invite you to join the conversation and ask Dr. McVitie your own questions. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Dr. Danny McVitie to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. McVitie.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. And again, as I say, but still so rare, we get to have an in-studio guest and look the guest in the eye. It's great, great, great. So thanks for coming on in. Let's first find out a bit about your background. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about where you grew up, the factors that led to your deciding to become a veterinarian, and where you went to vet school.
Sure. Well, I actually grew up right here in Odessa, so just north of Tampa. I'm definitely a Florida girl through and through. Went to University of Florida for undergrad and vet school. So go Gators. Mm-hmm. I started Lap of Love shortly after graduating from veterinary school. I quickly realized after doing emergency medicine for a while that it's something that the veterinary profession, we're getting better and better at it, but we really don't get a lot of education at it.
So part of the normal vet school training really is minimal on this aspect and end of life stuff, hospice stuff, euthanasia, and how to sort of deal with that?
Minimal. And it's not the veterinary school's fault. It's the fact that these dogs and animals and our pets are going from the barnyard to our bedroom. So as they become more important in clients' lives, then I think the education will become more important in veterinary school too. So we had no even discussion of hospice at all in veterinary school. We had very small amount of euthanasia. I think probably only less than half of my classmates actually euthanize an animal in vet school. So it's a lot of watching and rarely do we actually get to, pushing that plunger is completely different.
Than watching it, hearing about it, or reading about it. Yeah. Well, so this is interesting. Obviously, you just kind of established that you sort of identified a need, but what sort of drew you beyond that? Had you had some experiences with hospice care, human hospice care, because mm-hmm. that's sort of mm-hmm. still an interesting link to make, and I just wondered how you connected those dots.
Yeah, and I volunteered for human hospice in undergrad, and it's funny how things happen in your life. You don't really know how it's going to come back and affect you. But in doing emergency medicine when I got out of vet school, and then knowing what human hospice does, there's clearly, we're, as veterinarians, we're dropping the ball. when it comes to end of life care. Clients would come in with an older cat or an older dog that has been diagnosed with a terminal illness, but the veterinarian just sent them home and said, call me when you're ready or you'll know. And they really had no direction. They had no, they had no help in deciding that. So, you know, and I really realized soon that that was something that we could do a better job of. And I wanted to implement and model my service exactly like human hospice when I first started. It has since evolved from that, and it is different than human hospice, clearly because we have euthanasia as an option.
Right. Well, we'll get into to some of those specifics, but maybe you could just sort of place when did you graduate, and so when did you start having kind of this notion that this is kind of the area that you not only wanted to pursue, but in a way kind of like develop?
I graduated in May of 2009. Mm-hmm. So I am a young veterinarian.
Yeah.
Within 3 months, I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I'm kind of, you know, the business side of me is very entrepreneurial. I love doing things on my own and having real ownership in what I do. So that coupled with my desire to help the pets in this certain aspect of it, mm-hmm. has led to the development of both the medical part of hospice care, but also the business side and where that has gone as well.
And maybe it'd be interesting if you could try to sort of place in context, you know, beyond your own practice, where this is in sort of the field of veterinary medicine. I mean, I get the sense that it's sort of a growing trend, but mm-hmm. but you
it's,
would know
it's
better
very
than
new.
I.
Very, very, very new. It has been around for a while, so veterinarians forget that they have done palliative care. So palliative care just simply means comfort-oriented, not curative.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of vets kind of maybe forget that they already do that, but calling it hospice helps the client understand what the steps are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So using that word is so important, but it is new and it's evolving. My business partner and I, we just talked at NAVC, the North American Veterinary Conference, which is the largest veterinary conference in the world, for 4 hours on hospice and euthanasia. So that goes to show you where it is in the veterinary community right now, that although it's been around for a while, it's just now coming into light. And also there's some people out there calling themselves veterinary hospice, but a lot of them don't have any veterinary oversight. So unlike human medicine where
Wait, hold on one sec. You mean these are people doing hospice for animals who aren't actually veterinarians?
Calling themselves a pet hospice or an animal hospice without being veterinarians. And humans have that, human medicine has that oversight, but in veterinary medicine, we don't have that oversight.
Wow.
Yet. So that's
So is there no legal way that people could be prevented from doing that? So let's just say, say I'm a very different person. So I say, hey, Dr. Muti gave me a great idea. I'm going to start my pet hospice business tomorrow. And I just put up a shingle or drive around and nothing could stop me?
Nope.
Well, but what legality would there be if I euthanize an animal with, again, no veterinary training? What does that mean legally?
That's kind of the issue, is that they're calling pet or animal hospice, but they're not actually doing any medical. It's more supportive. So it's all those adjunctive services that human hospice does such a fabulous job with,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing the massage and the counseling and all these things are so important to hospice care.
Yeah.
But yet it's neglecting the medical aspect of it. So no one can practice medicine without a license.
Right.
And you can't purchase the drugs that I need to help my patients without having a veterinary license and
right.
a DEA license.
Okay.
Both.
So they can kind of circle around
exactly.
what you do, especially when the time comes and there's really, you know, the animal really needs to
yeah.
be euthanized. They can't do any of that, but they can just call themselves whatever they want to call themselves and
yeah.
do everything else. And
but that's another big thing of mine is helping the veterinarians realize what we can do so that pet owners realize what veterinary hospice is, which is, you know, starting with the medical model, and the vets really can do something.
Well, yeah, so I thought one way to sort of maybe create a window into what an actual hospice vet like yourself does and how it works is by sort of comparing and contrasting what happens or used to happen when the beloved family dog or cat became seriously ill. So and I think it might be really helpful if we just try to make this as specific as possible and just have you kind of respond. So a few times on the show, I've mentioned, our, you know, late beloved cat, Otis, extraordinary cat. And, you know, I just, you know, I mean, obviously I love animals. We're going to be doing the show, but I just, you know, I've never kind of felt that way, before or since, that I felt about Otis. So here's the thing. Sometimes happens with older cats, renal failure,
mm-hmm.
related conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So then other parts of his health severely compromised. But here's the thing, and you kind of alluded to this earlier. You know, it was really difficult to sort of determine, you know, where that placed him and what to do and when to do it. Mm-hmm. And again, we have a great, great vet. So it wasn't even that. I think it was as much my own issues. I was extremely upset because I was extremely attached to this cat and I could see what was happening. But again, you know, without the information, that you probably provide, and without the information, that, you know, as much as we like talking animals here, a cat or a dog can't really say exactly how they're feeling. So identifying kind of when the end should come became fuzzy and blurry and emotionally complicated. And again, you hear the term quality of life bandied about a lot. But that's kind of an abstract term sometimes. So anyway, I was kind of a wreck, obviously, mm-hmm. Sounding like I am now.
Yeah.
But, so contrast, I mean, ultimately, finally, what I did is I actually asked our vet, you know, which again, I guess was a fair question. I didn't really know what else to do. Like, hey, if Otis was your cat, mm-hmm. based on where we are now.
Exactly.
Yeah. And she said, you know, I think I would euthanize him now.
Yeah.
So that's what we did.
And that's what we did.
Yeah. Yeah. But tell me, kind of contrast my own experience then. This was a few years ago, certainly. Mm-hmm. With like, if I came to you now and unfortunately had a similar situation, what would be our first meeting and what you would tell me and how, you know, sort of guide me a little bit from there.
Yeah. And it's highly variable when somebody calls me. It's highly, are they calling me at the beginning or at the end? And luckily a lot of times people have such great guidance from their regular vet that they know, you know, when to reach out to someone like me that can provide something that their regular vet doesn't do, i.e. in-home care,
mm-hmm.
in-home euthanasia.
Right.
So, I mean, first of all, I'm so sorry about Otis. I mean, renal failure is something that happens. I mean,
yeah.
It's probably 30% of my calls.
I'm sure.
Are
yeah, very
cats
common
with
in cats.
Very, very common.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
the organ of least resistance, I guess.
Yeah.
So when they're first diagnosed, a lot of times you're hearing the dreaded phrase, there's nothing more I can do. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we should ever say that. We should never say there's nothing more I can do. There's no more curative options that we have. Now let's go into this hospice phase where we're going to do in renal failure, fluid, maintaining the quality of life. So if there's vomiting or diarrhea or pain issues, we address all of those things. It's symptomatic care.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a runny nose, we're going to give you something that's going to drive the runny nose instead of just curing a cold. So that's what hospice is symptomatic care, helping them be comfortable throughout that phase. So sometimes people are going to call me at the beginning and I can help them, you know, do certain things in the home. A lot of times I'm sending them back to their regular vet, say, I want you to talk to your regular vet about this because I can't do this in the home. So I can't do certain things in the home. Obviously it's very, very difficult.
Okay.
But a lot of the times I'm getting that at the very, very end. So we're within, you know, cats can live with a year or more on renal failure. Not all of them,
mm-hmm.
but some of them.
Yeah.
So a lot of times they're calling me at the very end and we're within a few weeks of the cat passing. So most important thing I need to do is explain to them what is going to happen. So what I'm explaining for a cat with renal failure is completely different than a little Yorkie with congestive heart failure.
Sure.
Totally
yeah, we might
different.
Come back to that and broaden this out. But I just thought, again, it might be really helpful just yeah. for people listening just to have something very specific just to really get a sense of what you do. And what
so
you,
number one, it's, yeah. no, it's understanding the medical condition that their pet is going through. So that they have to understand what is the pet going through. You know, they can't talk to us about pain. So let's help them identify signs of pain and then identify signs of actual passing. So here's what could possibly happen. If, you know, and this process of actual dying, a natural death is going to be different for a renal failure cat than, again, the Yorkie with heart failure.
Oh, right. But are you also saying that, like, let's identify what this would look like because given his condition, he might just die before we even think about or get to euthanizing. Is that what you mean by that? Or,
yes,
yeah, okay.
And because I want the family to know what to look for.
Right, when it's that much closer to
right.
the end, you mean?
When we're getting there. So they need to know
right.
what to look for, and
okay.
they also need to know what they're up against. Sometimes people are like, oh, my gosh, I don't want that to happen to my animal.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, this is why I want you to make the decision sooner than perhaps you want to make the decision.
Right.
But I want you to be educated about what can happen if you wait.
Sure. And let's just let folks know, if you just tuned in, we're speaking with the hospice veterinarian, Dr. Danny McVitie. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Dr. McVitie a question, offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. So, okay, so that kind of brings me to you know, what, I mean, we can kind of go in and out of still the Otis thing if you want, but I guess I'd be curious, what are the main questions and concerns that typically come up when you meet with new clients? I mean, I got to believe how will I know when it's time is kind of a key question.
Yeah.
And I would believe underlying that is the classic conflict that I certainly struggled with. You know, I want more time with Otis, but I do not want him to suffer.
Right.
So how do you reconcile those things?
Right,
I'm sure
right.
they're coming to you with those chief questions.
Yeah, and as a veterinarian, it's our role to help clients make that decision, but in the end, it really isn't our decision.
Sure.
You know, how I explain it to families is that there is a very large subjective time period in which an appropriate decision to make. Before which I'm going to refuse to euthanize because this animal has a quality of life. After which I'm going to insist on euthanizing because there is no quality of life and the pet is suffering. But the middle stage is a subjective period in which I need to help the family come to terms with what's happening and understand what the pet is going through. And then when the family decides that that is the right decision, because they know their pet better than anybody, it's my
sure.
job to give them the tools to understand their pet.
Yeah.
Then it's the right time. So there is not one moment, second, minute in time that is the perfect one. And you know, you're going to be racked with guilt if you do it before or after, but it's a period of time in which it is appropriate time.
And you establish that kind of, right up front. Cause I would think that it makes sense to hear what you're saying now. Hey, I would never euthanize prior to this period,
right.
and I must euthanize when the animal gets to this period.
Right.
But are there ever situations where, again, this is so emotionally complicated, I think, for most people, where they get to the point where you have identified it is time to euthanize, and they're still resistant
right.
or like, hey, I'm not ready now, and then what happens?
If families are first of all, I never say it is absolutely time, unless this pet
sure.
is suffering, and
right.
then I'm saying you need to understand what's going on.
Right.
If the family is resistant to me suggesting that it is an appropriate time, so it is a good time.
Yeah.
Then I really have to get to the bottom of what they're going through. A lot of times
right.
people have unresolved, you know, issues with death. Perhaps this happens a lot, that the pet is the child's pet, that and the child has passed away. I mean,
yeah.
all these horrible things that families go through, and this pet is the last remembrance item that they
right.
have from another family member. So
sure. So there's other issues at work.
There's so many issues,
yeah.
but
yeah.
being patient is the most important thing. And that's the great thing about animals is that they're so pure and they're so wonderful. And even when you can see that pet is hanging on for the owner, you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
that's okay.
All right. Well, let's, we've got some callers and some emailers, and I've got still many, many more questions, but
sure.
let's get some others involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Danny McVitie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to chime in.
Okay. Please do.
Happened to run across this, and, I just wanted to give a thumbs up for Dr. Danny there. I heard about her through a newspaper article a couple years ago, but last February our cat took a turn for the worse, and she came to our house and very, you know, nicely, professionally, and caringly put our cat down while we held the cat. And so, you know, I just want to give a personal endorsement. You know, we didn't want to take the cat to the veterinarian and dump him on a cold table and have him taken out that way, you know, so we found that her service was immeasurably valuable, that, you know, she came to the house and comforted us and comforted the cat, and it was a great experience, and frankly, it wasn't really any more cost than the vet. Unfortunately, our dog took a turn 2 weeks ago. We had to take him to the emergency hospital over on Bush Boulevard over there, and consequently, he was put down there, but price-wise, it wasn't any more for Danny, just so people get a hand on the price. But anyway, thanks,
so
Danny.
Thank you. What was your cat's name?
I'd rather keep
it. Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. No, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
You'd probably recognize him.
I probably would.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I'm so sorry for your loss of the cat and the dog, and I appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
Yeah, okay. You guys have
thank
a good day.
Thank you.
Okay.
You too.
And he made a passing reference to cost, and I've got an email question about that. But, you know, we're not typically on the show here or on WNF as a nonprofit, non-commercial station allowed to talk about prices and things. But I was going to get into a few times here anyway that the website for Lap of Love Veterinary Hospice is simply lapoflove.com. So you can find information on Dr. McVitie and other vets. We'll get into that probably too before we're done here. But it's you know, there's other vets that provide veterinary hospice care across a number of areas and even states now. So lapoflove.com, and they're also on Facebook too. So anyway, let's see. So one of the things, yeah, that you just touched on that I was going to ask you about, and you gave an example of, like if there was resistance because maybe that pet was particularly tied to a kid or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is how much the human client, like his or her experience with pets, his or her attitude about illness, death, loss, shape your approach differently from client to client. I mean, it sounds like that's kind of a key, mm-hmm. Factor in the whole calculus mm-hmm. here.
It is. It's a lot of listening, and human hospice knows that. That's what they're so good at is just sitting and listening to the client and helping them evaluate their pet. And when I do an in-home consultation, that's really the most important part of what I do is sitting there for 45 minutes watching their animal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even about placing my hands on the animal because it doesn't matter at that point. The physical exam doesn't matter. It's about the quality of life and how that pet is interacting with the family, how the family is reacting to the pet state as well. You know, pets really go a lot off of our personality mm-hmm. and our moods and what
yeah.
we're feeling.
Sure.
And when people are having a particularly bad time deciding when the right time is, I tell them to just sit with their pet and ask their pet. And it might sound a little funny, but they will get answers. They come to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just simply comes to them. So there does become a point in which there's nothing more that I can say. And a lot of my clients are strictly over the phone. I've never even seen this pet before. But helping them understand and try to feel what their pet's feeling.
And what, Dr. McVitie, what percentage would you say of folks reach, you know, contact you when maybe there's just been a diagnosis made or in other words, there's plenty of time for more actual hospice care relative to the percentage of people who contact you and say, oh my gosh, our cat or dog is like probably days away or a day mm-hmm. away. Like so much more short term, in other words.
Right now, because of client demand and where hospice that word is in veterinary medicine, mm-hmm. 90% of my calls come with, I would say about 75% of my calls come needing me within 24 to 48 hours for an in-home euthanasia. So I'm usually spending 10 to 15 minutes on the phone with these families, helping them decide how to make that decision, when to make that decision, but the decision is imminent. The hospice part of it is growing. It is extremely difficult to charge for something like that because mm-hmm. obviously going to your veterinarian and taking 20 minutes of their time is completely different than me taking, 2 hours of my time to go in home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to charge for something like that and to make it a viable business thing.
Right.
And yet still help the family. So I'm working a lot of things. I'm hoping to get a technician program where mm-hmm. actually technicians can go out and do a lot of these calls. Technicians
okay.
are fabulous. You know,
sure.
they're going to be a third of the cost of a veterinarian.
So you mean more when the hospice part kind of develops to develop that part where it wouldn't necessarily
yes.
be you in that case because it's like, you know.
If they just need somebody
right.
with some medical knowledge to come look and see
right.
and
sort of monitor and keep coming back and
right.
tracking that animal.
So that's a
yeah.
big project for me this year. But it is so difficult because the demand isn't up there yet. But as hospice grows in this field of medicine, it will continue to grow in demand.
Cool. Well, I got a couple of emails I want to incorporate as well. This one says, for a number of years, I've adopted older kittens who were given up for various reasons. My vet at the Animal Hospital of Treasure Island has been a godsend dealing with later life and hospice issues. It's very hard emotionally at this time of the animal's life, and we've been blessed with the love and care shown by my vet and his staff during these difficult times. Peace. And then This one says, the subject heading says, ditto what first caller said. I referred a couple of people, and they were very pleased. So obviously
that's
they
very
need
nice.
Thank you. So again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Truss. My guest is hospice veterinarian Dr. Danny McVitie. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. And again, if you have questions about the health condition and other sort of issues, related issues to what we're talking about with your own animals at home, obviously Dr. McVitie would be happy to respond to those. So, and Ash, which brings me now maybe to kind of a question I was wondering about anyway. I know you haven't been doing this long. It sounds like you're a couple years or so into this, but still in the formative stages of your career as a hospice vet, when you were spending, and as you do now, but still every day with terminally ill, you know, animals and helping some or a lot, the larger percentage it sounds like, over the sort of the Rainbow Bridge, and spending time around a lot of sad and upset people, as I was in the thing, and I almost sort of became that again, recounting it. What sort of emotional toll does that take on you, or did that take on you personally?
When I first started, I still remember, it was yesterday, I still remember the first euthanasia that came in. I was doing emergency medicine. And I couldn't do it.
What does that mean exactly?
I couldn't push the plunger. I couldn't go into the room and just do that.
You just kind of froze, or you just were so upset?
I was just so upset. I'm thinking, mm-hmm. How in the world am I going to do this? You know, and that's a lot of when people say, I used to want to be a vet, that they say, I just couldn't do that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's such a huge part of what it's the most important thing that we do.
Yeah.
And so another one of the doctor had to go in and do that one. But I saw it done poorly quite a few times. So
euthanizing an animal.
Yeah. And what I mean by that is this, that the family didn't get the calm caringness that they deserved, that they mm-hmm. needed. It was more of kind of a rash thing. So I knew that I could certainly do it better than that. I'm like, for goodness sakes, I have hospice, you know, volunteer time. So I mm-hmm. knew I could do it better. And I started doing it, and I was clearly doing it well. The technicians would come get me when, they had a particularly bad or, not bad, a particularly, difficult case, or difficult clients, you know, mm-hmm. that needed that extra attention. So I obviously had a knack for it. And, you know, it's very strange. It's nothing that I ever thought that I would be doing or necessarily even wanted to do. But, when you handle it properly, it is such a, it's such a gift to
yeah.
the family.
Yeah. Well, it's huge.
When it's done right. Yep. And for them to have seen their pet comfortable and calm and know that it was done in the right way, I think it starts the healing process even before that pet has actually passed.
Well, and as our first caller alluded to, and I think this would have made a big difference for me, and I'm sure for many, is the idea of having it done at home versus, you know, and again, a lot of vets' offices and animal hospitals are, you know, great, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, when it comes to that, there is something, you know, sort of distinctly different about at home, familiar surroundings versus, you know, even the nicest, mm-hmm. Warmest examining room
exactly.
is still an examining room.
Yeah.
So,
and if you ask any veterinary technician, office manager, receptionist, they always, everyone that's in a veterinary clinic will always euthanize their own pets in their home. So that's another big thing with
mm-hmm.
me is that if we're going to do that for our own pets, why aren't we going to allow that for clients.
Sure.
And suggest
help that, yeah.
and implement it and even push it, because those good clients that need that extra care, they you want them to go out and get a puppy sooner. You want them to be healing from the loss that they've just had, because there's so many pets out there that need good homes.
And so I guess back to my question, and when you said you know when the first one came you couldn't do it. And I mean, have you sort of had to develop kind of like a strategy to just to protect yourself from kind of emotional wear and tear? I mean, mm-hmm. doing this day in and day out. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, how do you sort of get through those days when, you know, that's what you're seeing every day?
It's long. It's like,
yeah.
And I have to at some point, and I have learned to almost step out of my body and just do it.
Mm-hmm.
So just
yeah.
kind of walk myself
yeah.
through those mental things and the physical actual doing of the procedure. I just simply have to do it. Very frequently, actually more frequently now that I'm been doing this for a while, I find myself even getting more emotional.
Really?
So it's kind of fun. I've talked to a lot of veterinarians that do this, that the longer you do it, the more emotional you get, because at the beginning when you're first starting, It's a lot of technical things. Am I doing this right? Oh, I remember this, do this, make sure I do this,
yeah.
make sure I do that.
So you're
But the better you get at it,
yeah.
yeah, the more comfortable you are, and then your mind is in with the family more. So I frequently get teared up, and you know, it's difficult, especially when there's children there, and
yeah.
you know, this is the child's first loss that they've
wow.
ever had. And so it is, but I think that the families take a lot of comfort in me being strong and calm and compassionate.
Yeah.
And, you know, they teach in the veterinary school, just never how to do the client with your emotions.
Right. Well, but also, know? Too, I mean, to me, one of the things that seems so important about what you do, because so many of us, you know, need that or needed that at a critical time, is guidance. It's like you say, I mean, you can't say exactly here's what you should do and when, but even if you have a lot of experience with animals, I mean, the situations are all different. And your emotional feelings often are different about those animals. So you still need, a Dr. McVitie or someone to say, okay, here's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're not there yet, but you have to sort of prepare yourself that this is what you need to look for. And
yeah.
when we start to see this, it's going to be time, you know. And I just think that's a huge service. And I just think, and again, to have that happen at home, I just think that's just tremendous,
yeah,
you know.
Definitely.
So, all right, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, Dr. McVitie, but let's try to work at least one more call. And hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Danny McVitie.
Hello, is this me?
It is. It's your turn.
Oh, I just wanted to give a testimony of about a vet I had. I would even want to use his name. I don't know if I should.
Okay. Well, you can just kind of give us the...
That was many years ago, maybe 15.
Okay.
He came to my house and euthanized my dog and took her away.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to his office, there was no charge. And he was so wonderful about
wow.
it. I just wanted to say that. Thank
wow.
you.
Wow. Well, that's a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you.
So, and again, that's a lovely, lovely story. But I mean, you know, this is how you make your living. So unfortunately, that's not going to be the case typically. But again, people can find out, you know, just sort of prices for general things and just how it works by going to lapoflove.com. And again, as I mentioned earlier, they're also on Facebook.
A lot of vets will do that. And the major thing with them, first of all, for everybody out there that might be interested in this, ask your vet. Ask them if they will. The problem is that it is very difficult for them to leave the office.
Sure. It's complicated.
It's very, very difficult. And not only that, but you have to be set up to do it. So you have to have all your plan B, C, D. I mean, this is medicine.
Yeah.
You know, things can go wrong.
Right.
So you have to be set up to do that. And that's why a lot of vets will end up sending me the case instead, because they're just simply not up or they can't afford to leave the clinic.
Well, we just probably have less than a minute now, but that was one of my sort of other key questions, is that, you know, other than sort of word of mouth or reading that newspaper article, or maybe today now hearing about it on the radio, I mean, how do people know to get in touch with you? I mean, are other vets referring you? How do people come to you typically?
There are a lot of wonderful vets out there that definitely give out my name and number, which is so great, because I don't do any general practice, so I never, you know, compete with a regular veterinarian at all.
I gotcha. Yeah.
So that's an important part, and that's why the there's so many wonderful vets that will refer me. But yeah, obviously the website and calling me or emailing me and.
Okay, cool. Well, we have a late breaking email, and I just want to throw this out to you too. So, the separate line here is, your thoughts on animals leaving one to die. We have had an outdoor, by her choice, feral calf for about 9 years, and believe her to have been 11 or 12. She's been missing for a week and a half now, and my husband believes that prior to her leaving, that she'd not been acting right. She didn't look well either. Do you believe some pets will go off to die to spare the parents the agony? We weren't that close to her, but hope she's in a much better place. Thanks for any insight.
Absolutely, yes. And that's actually one of the more common symptoms that I hear, and I will actually ask people, are they going somewhere they don't usually go?
Mm-hmm.
Forcing themselves under a coffee table that they've never been for, behind a bed, behind a dresser. So that's a very, very common thing that even indoor animals, and it, of course, including outdoor animals, do as well. And it's not necessarily sparing the family the agony, but more of sparing the pack the bringing in of any predators. That's the theory that we all have.
Oh, interesting. Okay, because I've known about this phenomenon for a long time, but I didn't know that was kind of the explanation for it.
Right, that's the theory, of course.
Yeah, all right. Sure. So we get these animals actually talking. It's hard to know for
exactly.
Sure. All right, well, Dr. Danny McPhee, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. Again, the name of the practice is Lap of Love Veterinary Hospice, lapoflove.com for more information. And again, they're on Facebook. Thanks so much for coming in and telling us some really, really important information for all kinds of folks, whether they have brand new puppies or kittens or much older pets. We're all going to sort of need this information at some point. So thank you again.
Thank you, Duncan.
All right. Okay, so I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to see Frank Zappa tribute band Ugly Radio Rebellion, performing Friday night at the Orpheum. To the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune. And in a moment, we'll chat with Libby Busalis, get the latest installment of the Vegan Chronicles. As it were, right now, though, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Not surprisingly, we've got a full bank of lit phone lights. People seem to know this one. Again, we've tried to make it easy. What the heck? Let's have fun with it. Okay, we'll take them in order that came. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Sure, it's Crocodile Rock.
That's right. What is your first name, sir?
Jason.
Ethan?
Jason.
Oh, Jason. I'm so sorry. Okay, cool. That's right. Crocodile Rock. Well, that correct answer gets you a pair of tickets to see the Frank Zappa tribute band Ugly Radio Rebellion Friday night at the Orpheum. So stay on hold. We'll get you set up for that, and thanks for listening.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, man. Okay, right now, and folks, if you're listening, if you're on hold, you weren't Jason unless you're actually Jason. I don't know why. Every week now we have people saying, yeah, I won the tickets. It's like, what's your name? Sally? Well, Jason won them. Anyway, I think it's the whole thing and the radio signal on there. But anyway, it's all working out. But more to the point, we've got Libby Busalis back with us. Libby, are you there?
Hi, Duncan.
How's it going?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Thanks for giving us another update. So we spoke obviously a couple weeks ago, and at that point you were a few days into to going vegan, and so now we're kind of at about the 3 week mark, which, you know, as we discussed back then, is there's a lot of people who sort of want to advocate that and just say, hey, just give it 3 weeks, you know, really go for it for 3 weeks and just see how you feel. And if, you know, if you don't like it, then stop. But if you might find that you really do. So how is it going for you?
It's going well. 20 days tomorrow. And
okay.
I had kind of a mini meltdown just recently.
Tell. What did that involve?
I was getting really frustrated, and it was just really hard, and I was, like, kind of dreaming about all the foods that I could eat. And then when I went to the doctor, they said, you know, you really need to start having the B12 supplements. And
right.
I started taking that, and I actually felt better. So I think it was, like, my caveman instincts just, like, kicking in, saying, like, you really are lacking here. So,
okay.
I feel a lot better now, but I definitely had that moment of weakness and questioning, like, why am I doing this? And, you know, the support and everything from with the people that I'm friends with and my family, that's, been, you know, kind of polar. So it's been either helpful or kind of even more discouraging.
With, oh, really? Yeah, because I figured since one of the things we people that heard this a couple weeks ago will remember is that, you know, there seemed to be very kind of divided response amongst your friends. Your family generally was responsible, and some immediate family members are you know, jumped in with you. But what's that like when you know, now that it's, you know, a couple weeks later, and it sounds like there's still kind of a polarized kind of response. What is that like? What are people doing? What are people saying?
Well,
on both sides, yes, yay and nay.
Well, the yays are kind of jumping on board with me, and even people that thought, you know, how are you going to get your protein? How, you know, kind of questioning, like, why I'm doing this at all, and have actually kind of jumped on board in a way. Like, my sister was really skeptical, but after I made her watch Forks Over Knives, and a few other people did too, and those people kind of jumped on board, even if it wasn't full-fledged vegan. My sister's making more vegetarian meals and kind of filtering meat out a bit. Another one of my friends is following a vegan diet just during the week, and my sister is still going to have some meat, but not as much as she was. So, you know, they're slowly changing, you know,
sure,
their eating. And my mom, too, is really, you know, I was speaking about her last time.
Yeah.
She was a nurse, and she was, well, she is not eating lunch meat anymore, and she's using almond milk or soy milk, so... Slowly but surely, I think people are kind of coming around and seeing why I'm doing this.
Well, and that's really cool and interesting because, you know, again, a lot of people would say, hey, you know, any changes that you make, I mean, if you go feet first and stick with it as you've done, great. But for a lot of people, you know, some of these changes are smaller. I mean, I'm fascinated by the person who's got the Monday through Friday change going. Then I guess by inference, Saturday, Sunday, kind of back to the old eating. But you know, to me, you know, I think a lot of people that really, you know, more expert advocates about how this works and can work would say that, you know, you're having a great influence, it sounds like, in your kind of circle of friends and colleagues and family members, even if not everybody obviously is doing, you know, exactly what you're doing.
Right.
But what, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I think it is interesting that as kind of a mix of what all you're experiencing. What are the naysayer types? I mean, have they come at you with different forms of naysaying, or are they, oh my God, we thought you'd come to your senses 2 weeks ago? Or, I mean, what kind of things are they saying?
Oh, absolutely. I have that. I have a friend who, is a medical doctor, and she was really, upset with this decision, saying, you know, you need to get your protein. And then, you know, when I was quoting some things from Forks Over Knives, she was just, you know, oh, you can make studies look any way you really want. You know, I'd like to see that research. And, you know, but then afterwards, you know, after a little bit of talking, I was like, well, you know, I guess you can make that work, you know, kind of more agreeable.
Hmm.
And at first, immediately, she was just like really opposed to it, almost angry at me for doing it.
Wow. Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. I mean, it really, this is partly why I so appreciate you being willing to have these conversations, and hopefully we'll still continue them periodically, because, you know, I just think it's really, really interesting what happens. But I think, again, even with the people in your life that have made some changes, some seem like angry at you for doing it. But I mean, you know, the results and the impact are both kind of notable. And so how do you feel, just because we're sort of just, I guess, probably almost at the end of our time here, Libby, for this week. But so other than that, kind of what you described as that meltdown, and then it seemed like the B12 kind of evened you out. I mean, do you feel like, hey, I'm you know, I'm going to keep going, and, you know, I don't anticipate, you know, backpedaling or veering off, or how do you look at it at this point?
Well, I'm committed to the 60 days, so
okay.
I'm just going to, once I get closer to the 60 days, I'm going to reassess. But right now, I feel really good. I feel healthy. I have a lot of energy. I'm able to maintain my workouts, and I have not lost any weight. So that is like one thing that I thought I was.
Are you discouraged? Are you discouraged by that?
Oh, my weight is always just an issue.
Right. So. Well, no, because I think when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you certainly cited that as one, you know, one of the elements for, you know, making this decision. So, but you know, that you also may find that that just really starts to come at, right about now or in the next week or so, you know, so, but it sounds like either way, that's not the fact that you haven't seen that kind of weight loss you were hoping for. You know, you're not ready to hang it up or anything. Sounds like
no. Yeah. I still feel like it's a good choice, and I'm sticking with it. And the only problem that I've had, or something that's actually pretty going to be good for me in the long run, is having to develop more discipline and planning out my meals, which is also good for having, you know, a 1 year old.
Right. Also. Yeah, good for the family in a way. So
yeah,
well, cool, Libby. Well, again, thank you for speaking to us and making the time, and good luck and hang in there. And sounds like again, you're really in for the 60-day thing, and you know. But again, if you don't mind, we'll check in with you another couple 3 weeks down the road and see how it's looking then.
Sounds good. Thanks, Duncan.
Okay, thank you, Libby. All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, February 1st, when our guest will be Nathan Winograd, nationally known author, speaker, and founder of the No-Kill Advocacy Center, who will be speaking on the no-kill topic at a conference at the West Shore Marriott on February 4th. Ticket and other details about the conference are at Save 90, the numeral 90, save90.org. Hope you'll join us then. And we have, of course, at TalkingAnimals.net, archives, Facebook page link, Twitter feed, and more. And, of course, Talking Animals Broadcast Outreach Consultant. This is Libby Busalis. My thanks to her. Double thanks today. And good luck. Keep hanging in there. She's doing great, obviously. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott, the All Souls edition of It's the Music. As always, we're closing out today's show with an animal tune. This is the Ryan Montbello Band with Songbird, taking us up to the NPR News on WNF Tampa. We'll see you next Wednesday at 11 a.m. for Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Thanks.
Sweet little songbird sitting on a wire. Sing the fire from your belly so small. Sound waves roll and the waves spread wide. You sing your song until it's 6 feet tall. Walking, stomping, stalking down the sidewalk. Wearing clothes, standing side by side. Fly little songbirds on to the next stop. You sing your song, you look each other in the eye like. Who can tell you not to sing your story? Who all can tell you that you're singing off key? You are the dance, you are not the dancer. You are the song, not the one who sings. Be a beautiful song, songbird. Now be a beautiful song, songbird. Now be a beautiful song, songbird. And you tell the truth.
NPR News in Washington. I'm Lakshmi Singh. Arizona Democrat Gabrielle Giffords bid farewell today to tearful colleagues in the House of Representatives as she resigned from Congress 1 year after being shot in the head at a Tucson shopping center. As NPR's David Wellner reports, many House members, including Speaker John Boehner, wept openly as Giffords took her leave.
It may well have been the most emotional moment to have occurred in the House in years when Gabby Giffords stood in the well of the chamber and submitted her letter of resignation. Giffords' close friend Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a Florida Democrat, read that letter on behalf of the retiring Congresswoman.
From my first steps and first words after being shot to my current physical and speech therapy, I have given all of myself to being able